Knowledge Products presents The Giants of Philosophy, St. Thomas Aquinas, narrated by Charlton Heston. Part 7.
So for centuries, philosophers had questioned and pondered the nature of the soul. In an unusually elaborate argument, whose length shows the importance of the topic and the lively controversy that surrounded it, Thomas establishes that there is but one soul in man. The soul is the intellectual principle that distinguishes man from other animals. Through the soul, man lives and feels and has his being.
It must be said that the intellect, which is the principle of intellectual operation, is the form of the human body. For that whereby anything acts is, in the first place, a form of the thing to which the act belongs. Thus, that whereby a body is primarily healed is health, and that whereby the soul knows primarily is knowledge. Hence, health is a form of the body, and knowledge is a form of the soul.
As always, Thomas gives his reasons.
The reason for this is that nothing acts except so far as it is in act. And so, a thing acts by that whereby it is in act. Now, it is clear that that by which the body lives is, in the first place, the soul. And as life manifests itself through various operations in different degrees of living things, that whereby we primarily perform each of all these vital actions is the soul. For the soul is the primary principle of our nourishment, sensations, and local movement, and likewise of our understanding. Therefore, this principle by which primarily we understand, whether it be called the intellect or the intellectual soul, is the form of the body. This is the demonstration used by Aristotle.
So the intellectual soul is the first and specific form of the human body. Thomas now considers the soul in itself. The human soul has a power that it exercises alone. This is the activity of understanding. Not only does this distinguish man from other animals, but it's an activity that a bodily organ can't perform. The body must always be located in this or that particular situation and be restricted by this or that set of definite conditions, circumstances. The body's nutritive and sensory powers are also restricted to a definite time and place. We see only as far as the horizon and from our own limited point of view. But in understanding, the mind is not confined in these ways. Of course, the human individual, body and soul, is the one who knows things. But he knows by transcending in time, place, and matter. Thomas says further,
"The human soul, by reason of its perfection, is not a form immersed in matter or entirely embraced by matter. The soul is separate according to its intellectual power, because an intellectual power is not the power of a corporeal organ, as the power of seeing is the act of the eye. For understanding is an act which cannot be performed by a corporeal organ, as can the act of seeing. Nevertheless, the soul exists in matter, insofar as the soul itself, to which this intellectual power belongs, is the form of the body."
To sum up how Thomas sees it, the soul is a non-material form of the body, and this soul can act through its own resources independently of the body. Over 1,500 years before Thomas, Plato had described an idea as a kind of form. Now Thomas has described the soul as the non-material form of the body. He goes on to say that forms in nature are found in various steps or grades.
"The nobler a form is, the more it dominates corporeal matter, the less it is immersed in matter, and the more it surpasses matter by its power and its operation. Hence, we find that the form of a compound has an operation different from that caused by its elements. And the higher we advance in the nobility of forms, the more we find that the power of the form surpasses the elementary matter, as the vegetative soul excels the mineral form, and the sensitive soul excels the vegetative soul. Now, the human soul is the highest and noblest of forms, and so, in its power, it surpasses corporeal matter by the fact that it has an operation and a power in which corporeal matter has no share whatever. This power is called the intellect.
The ladder of forms leads up from inorganic forms through the various kinds of souls and even beyond the intellectual soul. Each step moves away from the conditions of matter and more towards the freedom of spiritual being. We've seen that Thomas believes the essential nature of knowledge is to transcend the conditions of matter. Light, more light, the Greek hero is supposed to have cried, and Thomas takes up the cry. In an earlier part of the Summa, he asks whether there is knowledge in God. His answer tells us a good deal about what he takes to be the root character of knowledge.
Knowing beings are distinguished from non-knowing beings in that the non-knowing possess only their own form, whereas the knowing being is naturally disposed to possess also the forms of other things, for the species or likeness of the thing known is in the knower. Hence it is manifest that the nature of a non-knowing being is more contracted and limited, whereas the nature of knowing beings has a greater amplitude and extension. That is why the philosopher says that the soul is, in a sense, all things. Now, the contraction of a form comes through the matter. Hence, according as they are the more immaterial, forms approach more nearly to a kind of infinity. Therefore, it is clear that the immateriality of a thing is the reason why it is cognitive, and the manner of cognition is proportioned to the mode of immateriality. Hence, it is said in Aristotle's book On the Soul that plants do not know because of their materiality, but sense is cognitive because it can receive species or images free from matter.
Thomas now reaches his point.
The human intellect is still further cognitive because it is still more separated from matter and unmixed.
In brief, immateriality is the currency of knowledge, intelligence is its broker, and intelligible meanings are its coin. Turning back to the question, Thomas draws a conclusion about whether knowledge is in God.
Since, therefore, God is in the highest degree immaterial, it follows that he possesses the highest kind of knowledge.
Intellectual knowledge, then, is a sign of the spirituality that energizes the human center. But for Thomas, the human being is the lowliest of spiritual beings, a sort of suburban dweller among the community of spiritual beings, a rustic living on the border of time and eternity. The levels of physical reality in man are joined with the spiritual soul to form the unique human composite of matter and spirit.
Man, in a certain sense, contains all things. Now, we may consider four things in man: his reason, which makes him like to the angels; his sensitive powers, whereby he is like the animals; his natural powers, which liken him to the plants; and the body itself, wherein he is like to inanimate things.
Man's very complexity, however, removes him from the full actuality of spirit. For Thomas, human knowledge is relatively empty, but he doesn't agree with Plato that the soul knows things by remembering them from before birth. Thomas says the soul must learn from its situation in the human body. Nothing is known naturally unless it's drawn from experience. We must continually learn by looking, listening, feeling, remembering. This is what Thomas means when he says that the soul is in the body for the good of the soul and therefore for the good of the whole person.
If Plato were right, then the union of the soul and body would not be for the soul's good. It is clear that it was for the soul's good that it was united to a body, and that it understands by turning to the phantasms. Nevertheless, it is possible for it to exist apart from the body, and also to understand in another way.
Thomas proves, to his satisfaction, that the soul survives death and the corruption of the body. Still, after death, the separated soul loses its ordinary powers, so that divine grace alone can come to the rescue. Indeed, Thomas's theology brightens the fate of the soul separated from its body, since it promises to fully restore the soul and body in the resurrected and transformed human being. Philosophy, on the other hand, has little to say about the state of the separated soul. Still, Thomas's philosophy does have something to say about the soul after death. He affirms that the soul survives, but his philosophy says little about what its condition is. By its nature, the soul has many powers. These include the vegetal powers of nutrition, growth, and excitation, and the animal powers of sensation, perception, memory, and imagination. But the soul exercises these powers by means of the body. Lacking bodily organs, they withdraw after death into a latent state within the soul. Thomas's philosophy also says the soul possesses the rational powers of understanding and choice. He takes as his principle the following maxim: operation follows upon being. In other words, the kind of activity that anything performs will tell you what manner of being it is. It follows, then, that if the soul can here and now transcend the bodily situation, then it exists right now with an active being that transcends the fate of the body. With this reasoning, Thomas arrives at his distinctive solution. The soul is not only the form of the human body, it is also a substance, something in its own right. But he adds, it's an incomplete substance. To be sure, Thomas says the soul continues to exist even after separation from the body, because it is immaterial. The soul's immaterial because it can perform an action that transcends its material being. But the soul's natural state is to be united with the human body as its form. Apart from that union, the soul is incomplete. Thomas's solution satisfied neither side of the debate about the soul. Not the Platonists, who thought that the human soul is a complete substance without any essential connection with the body. Surely not the materialists, who thought the individual soul is merely an effluence of the body, without any independence from it. Among the materialists were philosophers who based their view on their understanding of certain Arabic thinkers. They argued that the individual human being was wholly material and mortal. When it was pointed out to the materialists that individual human beings transcend the mortality of their bodies whenever they arrive at objective knowledge, they replied that such knowledge does not belong to the individual at all. Rather, it belongs to a kind of common mind in which individuals share whenever they gain true knowledge. The materialists posited a sort of common intelligence of the race, separated from individuals. Against the materialists, Thomas defends the integrity of each individual knower. He argues that an individual's knowing and choosing are his alone. Knowing and choosing reside in the ambient core of truly spiritual being, and that domain is also the home of individual freedom.
We are masters of our own actions by reason of our being able to choose this or that. Man is said to be made to God's image, insofar as he is an intelligent being endowed with free choice and self-movement, and is the principle of his actions, having free choice and control of his actions.
Thomas devotes the longest, and many say the most original, section of his Summa to the question of human freedom and its outcome. The first half of this section is devoted to human destiny, to the actions that lead toward fulfillment or away from it. For Thomas, the meaning of an action stems primarily from the objective which calls it forth. The technical name for such an objective is the end of the action, or its finality. Commenting on Aristotle, Thomas puts it this way:
if we inquire what is the good intended in any act or any enterprise, it should be known that the good is that for whose sake all else is done. For in medicine, all is done for the sake of health. In the military art, all for the sake of victory. And in building, all for the sake of making a house. Also, in any business at all, there is an intended good for whose sake all is done. Now, this intended good in each and every work or act of choice is called the end, for the end is simply that for the sake of which all else is done.
Thomas frequently employs the maxim, every agent acts for an end. The end prompts the agent, calling but not compelling the action into being. Thomas asks whether human life has an ultimate end or finality, and what that end might be. Taking his stand with Aristotle, Thomas argues that the ultimate end of human life is happiness, though not everything that promises to contribute to happiness really does so.
If we immediately discover an end to which all that is done in the human arts and works is directed, then such an end will be the good that is worked for, absolutely. That is, it will be what is intended, at least indirectly, in all human works. But if in this matter several goods are discovered, reason must transcend this plurality until it comes to the thing itself, that is, some one thing. For man's ultimate end as man must be one by reason of the unity of human nature, just as there is one end for the medical doctor as a medical doctor because of the unity of the medical art. And this ultimate end of man as such, and not only as doctor or soldier or builder, is called the human good, which is happiness.
Now, concerning perfect happiness, Thomas finds the ultimate end of human life to be friendship with God. We pursue felicity in this life, but what alone will satisfy us completely is that face-to-face vision of God in which we share our life with God and God shares his with us. The uncertain happiness we find in this life, Thomas calls felicity. The ultimate happiness we attain in a face-to-face encounter with God, he calls beatitude. Having defined the distinctive nature of man and his capacity for thought and freedom, Thomas clarifies the proper meaning of the human act. He says that all actions are not acts. Some we do without thinking. A man scratches his beard without thinking. A woman fusses with her hair. We all digest our food and breathe normally without thinking about it. These are all actions of human beings. But what Thomas calls human acts require some degree of thought, deliberation, and choice.
Among man's acts, only those proper to man as man are properly called human actions. For it is as master of his own actions that man differs from other non-rational creatures.
Non-rational creatures, such as insects, fish, birds, and animals, are moved by instincts, by species-inherent drives and similar forces. People also have these specific drives for food, pleasure, and survival. They're given to us in our animality, but we're called to complete or perfect our humanity as responsible individuals.
So only those actions of which man is master are properly called human. Now, man is the master of his acts through his reason and will, and consequently, free choice is spoken of as the power of will and reason. Hence, acts properly called human are those that proceed from a deliberate act of will. Other actions belonging to man can certainly be spoken of as actions of man, but not properly as human actions, because they do not belong to man as man.
As the Summa Theologiae proceeds, Thomas begins a detailed examination of our passions or emotions, our habits, our virtues and vices. We share the passions with other animals as we respond to the challenges and attractions of our natural and social situation. We love or hate, we're attracted or repelled, we take delight or sorrow in our relationships. The enticements and frustrations of the good and evil in our situation move us to hope or despair, to audacious or timorous response, maybe even to anger. These emotions in themselves are neither good nor bad. They become so only in their concrete setting of freely chosen human actions. Nevertheless, the repeated experience of certain passions, coupled with repeated choices and actions, dispose a human agent to certain patterns of behavior. His conduct is directed along the lines of more or less stable actions. This stability is founded upon habits, such as a disposition to generosity or a tendency to lie. Because habits, as distinct from immediate feelings and emotions, are the product of repeatedly willed actions, we do speak of them as good or bad.
sensory powers can be considered in two ways. First, insofar as they act from natural impulse, and second, insofar as they act under reason's rule. Insofar as they act by natural impulse, they are ordered and determined, just as nature is, to one thing or outcome. But insofar as they act under reason's rule, they can be ordered to various things. In this way, sense powers can have habits by which they are well or badly disposed towards something.
Today we usually restrict the term virtue to moral actions, but the word is broader for Thomas. A virtue is any disposition towards authentic human good, a sort of habit of doing good. Vices are habitual dispositions that tend away from good. According to Thomas, a morally virtuous man is one who acts as he ought to act with regard to God, to other people, things, and himself. A moral virtue is a habit of the mind by which we live righteously. The web of lesser specific virtues hangs upon the chief or cardinal virtues: prudence, justice, temperance, and fortitude. Thomas distinguishes the cardinal virtues according to the faculty within us that each is meant to strengthen and guide.
There are four subjects of the virtue of which we now speak, namely, the power which is rational in its essence, and this is perfected by prudence, and that which is rational by participation, and is threefold: the will, the subject of justice, the power of desire, the subject of temperance, and the power of resistance, the subject of fortitude.
The life of grace depends on the theological virtues, the gifts of faith, hope, and charity.
In relation to both intellect and will, man needs to receive, in addition to the natural virtues, something supernatural to direct him to a supernatural end. First, as regards the intellect, man receives certain supernatural principles, which are held by means of a divine light, and these are the things which are to be believed, and this virtue is faith. Secondly, the will is directed to this end, both as to the movement of intention, which tends to that end as something attainable, this pertains to hope, and as to a certain spiritual union, whereby the will is, in a way, transformed into that end, and this belongs to charity or love.
This is the end of Part 7. Please download Part 8 to continue.